Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. One thing I've been noticing for a very long time has been the weakness of the white right when it comes to legal stuff. The white right is at a big disadvantage with legal stuff. And I myself didn't know much about legal things until the Jews came after me. And they came at me furiously with everything they had. And I must tell you, it was quite a nightmare. However, I learned a hell of a lot of things from that experience. And nowadays, when I look at people in the white right and things that are happening to them, I'm very concerned by some of the things that I see. And I find it very concerning that people are ending up in jail, sometimes for things that could easily have been avoided. But in the white right, I must tell you that when you are involved in things in the white right, there are so many different issues that come up in this struggle, especially the struggle between whites and Jews, but also in other aspects of the racial struggle. And you find yourself having to deal with so many different things that you've not dealt with in normal daily life. I must tell you that I think that being in the white right, people should not be depressed and despondent, because you are going to learn stuff in the white right that you would otherwise never learn in life. There are things that you're going to be taught, things you will discover, not just about history, but about the way the world really works. And people should actually look at lots of these negative things, and people should start seeing them as positives, because you are starting to learn about different and important aspects of life. To give you an example, the average person sits and thinks that politics is just a case of going out, voting for a political party, and then going back to work, going back to the shopping mall, and carrying on with life as usual. But in actual fact, when you're in the white right, you begin to realize that there are lots of people, dedicated enemies, who work away at undermining a country, undermining the people, undermining the politics, sneaking around, gaining power, etc. The Jews, of course, being the prime scum among all of this. And now people in the white right get depressed and despondent that they vote for, let's say, Donald Trump, and they expect Donald Trump to be a racialist, they expect him to be Hitler, and he turns out not to be any of that at all, and he does all kinds of weird things. So they vote for their guy, but he still doesn't do many of the things that are important to the white right. And so now people begin to realize that, no, it's not just a case of picking anybody and voting for him. Politics is much deeper. And as I've pointed out, whites are going to have to create our own politicians and political parties. That is necessary. We're going to need politicians who can stand up and do the nasty stuff that has to be done that all these other wishy-washy politicians can't do. And the same goes for all other things, where people go and do certain things and people start thinking, okay, I need to go and speak out. Let me go onto Twitter or YouTube and I'll go and speak there. And you speak there and then you're banned. So now you discover that, yeah, I can't just speak anywhere. I now have to speak in places where I'm allowed to speak. But previously, you'd never even imagined that life could work like that. So the white right is filled with lots of nasty lessons. There are lots of nasty lessons that you learn in the white right, which previously, when you were just a hard-working rat for Jews and other rich people, and you were in a business, in a company, and you could say certain things, do certain things, just go to phone someone. If you need someone to help you with this, you phone them and you can speak to them. If you need someone to help you with the law, you just go and find a lawyer, quickly talk to him, bring him on board if you need him, etc. All those things that you are used to in normal life suddenly do not work the same way when you're in the white right. And it's a big shock to many people. And I want to tell you, the longer I do stuff in the white right, the more I see the need to create everything that we need. I've raised this many times, and I'm going to keep mentioning this. We have to create new things, because you'll find that lots of the normal stuff that you are used to is needed in the white right, but our enemies, primarily the Jews, will do their utmost to destroy that. Examples being video platforms. If it wasn't for a couple of decent video platforms, especially BitChute, but also Odyssey and World Truth Videos, and then others like myself with my own video platform, that now you realize, my goodness, isn't it difficult to be able to put out a video or put out an audio or do a show? You need to go to specialized places. The same is true for social media. And so the list goes on and on. And I want to tell you that the big lesson of the white right is that whites are going to have to create and run all sorts of things. Things which will have to be duplicates of things that are normally freely available in the rest of the world. There are many types of businesses that I've been sitting and thinking about that need to be created. However, today I want to show you an area where whites take a beating, and it is in legal stuff. In lawfare, when lawyers and courts and legal stuff and the police, when all of that is weaponized. And this is an area where Jews are way better positioned than you can imagine. This is an area where Jews work a lot. And it saddens me that I see someone going to jail. And this person's going to jail for years. And this person didn't even commit a crime, actually. And it really bugs me. And I'm seeing lots of this stuff. I'm very concerned by many things that I see. Because this is a big and complex topic, I will do more than one video about this. But I thought I would start by just doing something basic to just start telling people certain things, because this is a very important area. And the fact that Jews win so often in this game is very, very bad. And it causes people to really get terrorized by Jews. And people are petrified of certain things. So there's a lot of fear that comes out of this thing. Real fear. And another kind of fear that I've seen, for example, is people being afraid of banks and financial stuff. And they are very fearful that Jews are busy spying on them and doing things there. But at the end of the day, the problem is that there are ways in which whites get bashed. And of these methods, lawfare is the nastiest. There are people whose lives have been destroyed through this thing. On the screen in front of you, I put some images of two white guys in particular who I think were on the right track regarding lawfare, and they were busy doing stuff. On the left, top left, is my favorite photo of Matt Hale. That is Matt Hale with the Church of Creativity flag. I love that flag. I love creativity. I love the work of Ben Klassen. But unfortunately, at the time that Matt Hale was busy, I was oblivious to wondrous things like the Church of Creativity. The Church of Creativity was really starting to move in the 1990s. In the 1990s, there were people starting to push that thing. Including in South Africa, there was a professor who was the main driving force behind creativity. And there are quite a few older whites that I know, including guys who were in the AWB, who became members of creativity. And in Pretoria, the capital city of South Africa, and Pretoria, by the way, is very Afrikaans. And in Pretoria, there was a Church of Creativity in the early 1990s. And I've spoken to guys who are still alive, who were in that church. Unfortunately, nobody took photos. And so I don't have any photos of the Church of Creativity back then. But anyway, that is my all-time favorite photo of Matt Hale in his suit, the Church of Creativity flag, and doing a Nazi salute, Roman salute. And here is another one below that where Matt Hale is doing his Nazi salute. Lots of things happened in creativity. All kinds of things have gone on. Other people were also in control of it. It still exists, but I can't get anyone to talk to me directly. There are people that I tried to communicate with. They're not very forthcoming. But one thing which I could figure out about Matt Hale is that Matt Hale basically seemed to try to become the leader of creativity. Ben Clausen, the creator and the thinker behind creativity, was basically looking for someone who would spread the message. I forget the term that he used for it, but he had a particular term for the kind of person he was looking for, almost like a disciple, but there's another word he used, and I can't remember it at the moment. And Matt Hale seems to me to have been the guy who decided to take creativity and push it further, and he did the best he could. Now, when Matt was busy with creativity, there are quite a few things that I've found out about Matt. But I must tell you that Matt Hale came under a hell of a lot of attack when he was busy with creativity. Matt Hale came under serious attacks, and creativity people were even attacked physically. There's a lot more to creativity when Matt was doing it, and I'm amazed at how little people remember about the recent past. Not even the distant past, I'm talking the recent past. We are busy doing things, and many people are so despondent that they think, oh, this thing happened, that thing happened, oh, I'm so depressed, I'm going to quit. When in fact, I want to tell you that 50 years, 100 years, 200 years from now, there are going to be people wanting to know much more detail about the things that have happened to us in the white right. And people are not keeping proper records. People are not saving things away. There's a lot of stuff from the current time where people just look at an event, the event happens, and nobody bothers to record it. And I want to tell you that that's wrong and it's bad. There are many, many things that if people remember it, save away photos, save away videos, save away audios, save away people's books and writings. There are lots and lots of things that will be of interest to whites in the future and even in the distant future. This time that we're living through is a very interesting time, and we shouldn't be so despondent. We should be diving in to all kinds of nasty things, doing the best that we can with our resources, because we are not doing bad at all. And so when someone dies or someone goes to jail or something happens, then people flee, people forget the person, people throw everything away, etc. This is all wrong. This is all very wrong. But anyway, Matt Hale, from what I was looking at, Matt Hale was trying really determinedly to stand up for whites, and he was determined to do his utmost. I have been gathering some stuff about Matt Hale that I still want to put out one day, but it's not as important as the kinds of things that I'm trying to explain now. But there's a lot more to Matt Hale than meets the eye. And one of the most fabulous things that Matt Hale did was Matt Hale realized the importance of dealing in courts. And Matt Hale went and he studied to become a lawyer. And very unfortunately, by the time that he was getting to the point where he could become a lawyer, things were already so hot and he was under such pressure that then a bunch of things went wrong for him, and there was a spy on the inside. Someone who basically became a prime problem for him, who would testify against him in court. I'm not going to discuss Matt Hale's court issues. There was a girl that I did videos with several years ago when I was getting History Reviewed running. That young woman appeared on a show with myself and Alex Linder, and I communicated with her several times. I communicated with her a lot behind the scenes, and she knew a hell of a lot about Matt Hale's case, and she was doing her utmost to help him. Unfortunately, I cannot remember which Team Whites we did where she appeared, but she knew a lot about what happened to Matt Hale, and we discussed it. She has since disappeared. She disappeared years ago. but I do have her email addresses, and I decided to send off some emails to her to see if she's still around, because many times people just disappear out of the white right and they're gone. But she told me a lot more detail about Matt and how Matt ended up in jail. So I will discuss that a bit today. But Matt Hale was definitely on the right path when he realized the importance of really getting down and studying the law himself. He was on the right track, and it's something that I've been looking at myself. I've been looking at this whole legal thing, and it's bothering me more and more as time goes by. So that's what I want to discuss in today's video. So that's why Matt Hale is on the screen in front of you. Matt was onto something. The problem was the Jews managed to nail him before he could really get going. Plus, I think that despite him passing the bar exam, that they stopped him from actually practicing as a lawyer. But even so, he had the skills, and there's a lot to be said for what Matt Hale was trying to do. I want to chat about that today. On the right is another guy, Eustace Mullins. Eustace Mullins has written many books, and Eustace has a serious background. He met Ezra Pound. And it was Ezra Pound that got him onto the Jews and the bankers and all that stuff. Now, Eustace Mullins was a very active guy until he passed away in 2010. But right throughout his life, he was very active and always on the go. But one area where Eustace Mullins did something that is probably the best that's ever been done in the white right is he taught himself how to fight in court. And he even wrote a book about the rape of justice. Eustace Mullins seems to me to be the only guy ever in the history of the white right who was so aggressive legally that his enemies could try to do everything they wanted against him. And even if he lost in court, he never quits and nothing serious ever happens to him. And Eustace Mullins would run around and sue people left, right, and center. Anyone that gets in his way, that mucks him around and tries to shut him up, he goes and he sues them, he kicks their asses, he makes their life a misery. I must tell you, I have incredible respect for Eustace Mullins. And we're going to look a bit at Eustace Mullins' stuff today, but we will revisit Eustace Mullins more. Because when I see what Eustace Mullins was doing, and I sit and think about the things that happened to me in court, I want to tell you, there's a lot to be said for this. Now, the only other guy that I know who fought legal battles was Tom Metzger. But Tom Metzger was so organized, and Tom Metzger seems to have functioned with his own organization, that I think he could hire lawyers and get lawyers. So in his case, he didn't have a problem fighting in court. But what happens in the white right is that most people battle to fight in court. Most people struggle in court everywhere. And I myself went through such a nightmare. In 2018, I made probably my first seriously long video. And the video is called How to Fight Jews Legally. And that video is the story of a guy in South Africa called Snowy Smith. Snowy Smith's story is very fascinating. And I knew Snowy Smith. I never met him face to face, but we communicated a lot by email. I haven't heard from Snowy Smith in years, and it could be that Snowy Smith might even have passed away because he was already a pretty old guy at the time. So it's very possible that Snowy Smith has passed away. He used to live in Durban in South Africa. I probably last heard from him 2 years or more ago. But that video, How to Fight the Jews Legally, that is Snowy Smith's story. And it's a very, very interesting story. because Snowy Smith was a guy who was wealthy. He was an English South African who made a lot of money. He was involved in skateboarding. He had the world's biggest skateboard factory in South Africa, and he was making a ton of money in the 1970s. And he was dealing with Jews, and then a Jew destroyed him. A Jew who was one of his best customers actually totally destroyed him out of the blue, and Snowy ended up going bankrupt. The story of how the Jew destroyed him is itself a very fascinating story, and I tell it in that video. And then I tell the story of how Snowy started to learn to do legal things, because he was penniless and he had all kinds of people wanting money from him. He was being sued, and how he taught himself. So Matt Hale, Eustace Mullins, and Snowy Smith are three guys who realized the importance of having to learn about the law themselves, because they didn't have the money or their situation was such that there were no good lawyers that they could use. And when I was doing the video about Snowy Smith, he was still functioning as fair and civil law, because Snowy Smith was doing in South Africa what Eustace Mullins was doing in America. Only Eustace Mullins was operating on a much bigger scale. But Snowy Smith was also trying to teach people and help people deal with legal situations rather than being bankrupted due to the cost of attorneys. There were lots and lots of poorer whites who were struggling to get legal help, and Snowy was trying to help them. And when I see what happens to many whites, it really bugs me. There are too many people who are in the white right who are being destroyed, and I'm looking at what is going wrong with them. And a thing that particularly bothers me is when I see people being destroyed when it could have been averted. Whereas the Jews are so at home in the courts and with legal matters. They are like ducks in water. Whereas most whites don't have a need to go to court most of the time. It may happen once or twice in their lifetimes. Most whites have got no experience in courts, and they don't know how these things function. It's like politics, only worse, because in courts function in such a way that those who've got money have an edge, a big edge, on those who don't have money. And the attorneys themselves need work, and so they're just too happy to do whatever work any business or wealthy person can bring them. And so it's common whites and poorer whites who are the ones who really struggle. And of course, many people in the white right get attacked, and they get attacked by jury that's coming at them using experienced lawyers, experienced law firms. So what is happening in the white right is that lots of people believe that the law is rigged against them, that the law is totally useless, that you've got to steer clear of the law because you will be destroyed. And I must tell you, despite my nasty experiences, I actually realized that it's not so. That even in a country like South Africa, where I was absolutely convinced that everything legal was rigged against us, I actually realized that there is a lot of scope for fighting back. And I myself saw examples of whites being destroyed in South Africa and people being terrorized into submission by Jews, when in fact it's not needed. When in fact that person didn't have any need to fear anything at all. The thing that bothers me is as I see whites in the white right being regarded as criminals, the white right itself being regarded as a haven for criminals, and that anyone who's in the white right is either a criminal or a wannabe criminal. And then it gets even worse when you get organizations like Nordic Resistance being labeled as terrorists by the United States government. When I look at these things, I'm getting really concerned about what is happening in the white right when whites are not committing crimes. There are areas where the white right is losing, and it shouldn't be losing. And if there was just a bit of a better support mechanism, the white right would be winning. There are places where the white right stands a serious chance to do serious things. And when I look at the legal stuff, to me, it's an area of huge weakness. It's an area that is in very bad shape. And the problem is that people are really buggered up by the things that happen. Take Matt Hale. Matt Hale got a 40-year jail sentence. Matt Hale's 40-year jail sentence is probably the worst thing that's happened to any white in the white right. But they were so keen to get him into jail, and how he ended up in jail had to do with somebody he was talking to, and that person then turned around and became a state witness. Everything that happened to Matt Hale was a travesty of justice. Then take a look at people like Alfred and Monica Schaefer doing jail time in Germany over videos. In their case, they seem to have been able to assemble decent lawyers to fight for them. Their problem was that the Jews came after them, knowing that things that are legal in Canada are not legal in Germany because of these stupid, disgusting laws that are in Germany as a result of World War II. So the Jews knew that they could nail Alfred and Monica Schaefer on German soil because of German law. And in the end, Monica, when she got a chance to get out of jail, she got the hell out of Germany, and that was a wise move. But Alfred had to go and sit in jail for more than 4 years. Another person who got a raw deal was the guy who did the songs, Mr. Bond. Mr. Bond is actually a young Austrian guy, and he got a couple of years in jail. He's still in jail. I'm not sure when he's going to get out. And in one of his songs, he even used my voice. But I feel terrible when I think about young guys like that who are sitting in jail for freaking years. But the big problem with the Germans and the Austrians is that even if they have good lawyers, they are screwed because of the law. The simple things that they are doing in those countries are illegal. So if you're doing something that is legal in Canada, legal in South Africa, but you're sitting in Germany or Austria, then it doesn't matter, because the way the law works is the law of the land that you're living in is what applies. So it doesn't matter what Canadians do, doesn't matter what Americans do. There are things that Americans can say and do in America which no other whites on the planet can say or do. Of all the whites in the world, the ones who are in the best position in terms of freedoms of speech and the way to deal with politics, the way to deal with the law, white Americans are way better off than anyone else. And the whites who are in the worst situation are the whites who are in Europe, in countries where the fake crime of Holocaust denial can get them into jail. So you've got two extremes. The extreme good side is actually America. Despite many Americans complaining, the fact of the matter is, whites in America have got tons and tons of things that they can do that other whites on the planet cannot do. And the whites in the worst situation are the ones in European countries where Holocaust denial laws exist. That is the Germans, the Austrians, etc. And then the Canadians and South Africans and Australians and British are sitting somewhere in the middle. We're in the middle. We don't have all the freedoms that the Americans have, but we are not as bad off as the whites in Europe. Another man who I am quite concerned about is Leslie Borey in Canada, because Leslie Borey did some stuff on his podcasts and they grabbed him and tossed him in jail quickly. And he's on trial. He might even already be on trial right now at the time that I'm making this video, because I published an article yesterday on my website about Leslie Borey getting 2 weeks in court starting today, and he's going to be the test case for a new law in Canada, and it's Section 138. And basically, it's about incitement to genocide. And I think that he can get up to a 5-year jail sentence for this. I'm speaking off the top of my head, so I could be wrong, but I think he's already spent about 2 years in jail. And now, for the first time, he's going to get a chance to appear in court. And just my general feeling regarding what Leslie faces, it is my guess that Leslie's going to spend quite a few more years in jail. I think they're going to hit him hard. Recently, I was speaking to another guy in Europe, and this guy has just come out of jail. I was busy talking to him more than a month ago, and suddenly he went silent, and I hadn't heard from him for weeks, and I tried to find him again and communicate with him, and then he popped up and told me that he'd just spent a month in jail. Now, in his case, there was nothing that he did wrong. He ended up in jail for rubbish. And these things bother me. You see, in some cases, the whites are screwed. So let me explain a bit about how the law works. Because it seems to me that the vast majority of whites have got no clue how the law actually works. And the presence of the internet makes it so much more confusing. So I want to clarify how the law actually works. Because also as a website owner, in the early days when I had websites, I used to think to myself, well, if my website is hosted in America, then it's outside of South Africa and they can't touch me legally. That's how I used to think when I was inexperienced in this kind of stuff. But in actual fact, the way the law works is very straightforward. The only law that you have to concern yourself with is the law of the country that you live in. That's the only law that is going to apply to you. And it doesn't matter whether you've got websites in other countries. Doesn't matter about any of those things. Those things are all minor. The bottom line is, where do you live? That's all that matters. You can have things outside the country, but the issue is, where do you live, and are any of the things that you are doing in violation of the law? So if you're a German, then the only laws you need to worry about are German laws. And so Holocaust denial and all that other crap, all that other bullshit that was foisted on Germany by the Allies and the Jews, all that kind of garbage, I'm afraid, is what you have to be careful of. So that is where, sadly, young guys like Mr. Bond got into trouble. But there's no way out of it. People like the Schaefers and Mr. Bond off to jail because even though what they are doing is not a crime in any sensible country, the fact is that is the law in that country. And if you can be shown to have violated the law, it's jail time for you. And it doesn't matter where you put the stuff. You can put it on the internet, you can put it on someone else's site. But if they can trace it back to you and they can say, ah, Mr. Schaefer, you put a video over there on the internet hiding away in another little place, but we know it's you, we've got proof that it's you, or it's your face that's on there, then that's it, man. You're screwed. So the only law that people must ever concern themselves with is the law of the country that you're living in. That's the only law that applies to you. That's the only law that matters. The only time it gets more complicated is if you are really doing something that is illegal in another country. Then it gets more complicated because it depends on how serious that is, etc. But for most of these things that we are doing, we will never run into these issues. So the legal term for this is jurisdiction, that the laws that apply to you depend on where you live. Now, in the United States, you've got state law and federal law. So federal law applies to everybody in America, but otherwise, state law applies to the people depending on where they live. For the rest of us, we don't have that sort of breakdown. So for South Africans and Australians and others, we live in a system that basically has one set of laws for the whole country. You could basically say, let's call it federal law, applies to most everybody else. It is only in America where you've got state law and federal law. This young guy who ended up in jail for a month, he'd actually told me a couple of weeks before that. He said to me, oh, something came from the police and he's going to have to go to court. And then he was chatting about it. And I actually said to him after a time, I said to him, you know, you should take all legal things seriously. The moment that you get this thing, you should be jumping into action. And he then came back to me and he said, should I lawyer up? And I said to him, I don't know what this stuff is that's coming at you, because he didn't give me any details, but I said to him, it doesn't matter how minor a thing looks. The law is when you're dealing with the state, and the state can come and put handcuffs on you. The state can throw you into prison. And if you don't listen to the state can punish you because you are not listening to the state. That is how Western legal systems work. And there's nothing wrong with this. The systems are this way from lots and lots of practice over hundreds and thousands of years. This is how our things function. Just because we live in a clown world now, don't be fooled by that. The state is still the most powerful thing there is. Though there are all kinds of clowns and retards running around and messing around in the state, the fact of the matter is that white civilization functions like this. The state is a serious thing and it's got serious power. The state can do all the kinds of things that a normal person cannot do. It has to do with power. The state can restrain you. The state can even kill you. That is the nature of how countries function. So when state-related issues come up, especially if it's legal stuff, you should really jump and take a good look at this and not mess around with the court. Because the court implements the law. And if the court finds that you have violated a certain law, the court will punish you. It could fine you. It could jail you. It's got that kind of power. The court is not a business. The law of the country normally is not a business. Just because Jews and the super rich can flaunt all kinds of laws, let me tell you, don't underestimate the power of government and the power of the legal system. When this stuff is run properly by whites, this stuff is awesome. This is the stuff that quickly sorts out criminals and all kinds of scum and garbage. But now we've got enemies who come after us, and that makes it a whole new ball game. And especially with Jews, where Jews are very familiar with the system, and lots of Jews are involved in legal stuff, lots and lots of Jews are attorneys. So let me explain a little bit about the law and how legal stuff works. When laws are made in government, those laws have got a whole bunch of clauses to them. So the law will state certain things, depending on which kind of law you're dealing with, whether the law is one of these junk hate crimes or whatever. And it's going to say that this law has got this purpose. And these are, let's call it, the rules that relate to it. So if you get charged with something, with a crime, or they make a case, a civil case against you that relates to some kind of law, because you get criminal law, but then there's also civil law. So criminal law is stuff like theft and murder and fraud and that kind of thing. But then you also get civil laws, like family law. Things like family law, contract law, laws to do with properties, all that kind of stuff. All of that is civil law. Now, the difference between civil law and criminal law is very important. The really nasty one is criminal law. Criminal law, that's the one that can get you into big trouble. That's the one where the state is against you. So criminal law is when the state is coming at you. Criminal law is the really scary one. But there are some rules there that when it comes to criminal law, they have to find you guilty beyond reasonable doubt. So it's got to be like a mass of evidence that truly proves that you are guilty. So the standard for the state to prove that you are guilty is much higher in criminal law. In civil law, which normally involves one person against another or one organization against another, you win through the preponderance of the evidence. So it's almost like having an election, but you voted and you got 51% and the other side got 49%. Civil law works like that. Whoever has the slight edge over the other one, they win. So for the state to win, they've got to have tons of evidence and it must be literally a slam dunk. I know it doesn't always work that way, but that is the standard normally. But for civil stuff, it is just a slight edge. And whoever has a little bit better evidence than the other side, they win. Now, at the end of the day, the law is really a sort of a nerd exercise. It's the kind of exercise that nerds will enjoy. And I must tell you, despite the nasty things that happened to me, I began to appreciate this thing. And I actually walked away from it, despite all the negative, nasty stuff that happened. I actually walked away from it much more positive about the law, even in silly South Africa. I walked away much more positive than I'd been before. At the end of the day, you've got the law that's written down, and whether the matter is criminal or civil, at the end of the day, the real discussion is going to be about whether you or someone else violated that law. So if someone's coming at you and they're charging you with having broken the law, the whole discussion now rests on the technical details written in those words as to whether you did in fact violate that law. And if you did violate it, then how much did you violate it? Because the how much will determine your punishment. So, for example, if you are found guilty, but they can find, well, you really didn't do it with such malice or whatever, then you'll get off on a lighter sentence. But absolutely everything that happens legally is really a nerd exercise. And one of the interesting things I discovered, even in the 21st century, is that all legal systems work on paper. All legal systems work on paper and piles of paper. So it's the perfect world for a nerd to get involved in. Because those words on paper is what is going to determine the outcome. Now the law is the critical thing. And you have to actually look at the law that you are being charged with. So that law is going to have a whole bunch of stuff in it. And it'll say, under this condition, this is so, and under that condition, and this exception, but not that exception. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's in there, depending on the law that you're charged with. And for your defense, you need to know that law. So you need to actually go and get a copy of that law and read that law and look at which parts of that law now relate to the thing that you did. Because the whole issue is going to be whether you complied with the law or whether you broke the law. It's nothing more than that. And the way the law works is that it's basically a combative situation. It is about each side fighting it out to the maximum for their side. You are not there to strike deals with the other side. You are there to push your argument to the maximum for yourself, and the other side does the same. And that is why the judge or the magistrate or the jury are then going to see who does the best. The law and legal proceedings is a lot like a boxing ring. You go in there, you beat each other up to the maximum, and the guy who landed the best punches or who dealt the other one a knockout blow, he's the winner. Court is like that. Legal stuff is like that. So you don't run around in the court documents and say, oh, that stuff is wonderful, you're fantastic. No, no, no. This is about you winning, and you've got to attack the other side to the maximum. You've got to defend yourself to the maximum. You've got to work against the other side to the maximum. And if you don't do it, they will be doing it to you. So it's a vicious system, but that's the way life is. That's the way the world is. Get used to it. It's a combative system. This is the proven system that the Western world runs on. So one of the things that I learned, and this is to give you just a very basic strategy. One of the things that I learned from my lawyer and the lawyers I talk to, etc., is that if you find yourself in a situation where you are charged with either a crime or a civil action or whatever, there is no requirement for you to go and cooperate and admit to all sorts of things. Your goal is you need to put your best foot forward so that you freaking win, okay? So one of the things you can do is that whatever they charge you with, there will be a document that comes at you, and that document will lay down the details of what you are charged with. It will say you are accused of breaking this and this law, you did this and this, and that is why you got to go to court. And basically, when you are doing legal stuff and court stuff, it's a bunch of documents that go backwards and forwards. Here in South Africa, we use affidavits. It's known as an affidavit. But let me just tell you a bit about how it works in other countries. Let me just explain it in South African terms, and then I will convert it to terms that have meaning for people in other countries. Whether it's the police or whether it's another side, they will prepare an affidavit, and that is the thing that initiates it. And that affidavit is going to come to you. You are going to be the defendant, and you now have a chance to reply to the affidavit. So someone initiates the case against you, and you get their documents. Now you go and you are allowed to reply to their document. Their document will have a whole bunch of paragraphs. You know, paragraph one will say, you did this, this is the issue. Paragraph two will say, here's some more evidence, and so on and so on. And when you get that document with all their paragraphs, you reply to their document, and you reply to as many of the paragraphs in their document as you can. Preferably, you try to reply to them all, and you may yourself insert additional paragraphs of your own. So one document comes at you, and you have the right to produce your own document, and there's no limit on what you can put in there. So that is the beginning of your defense. This is before you even walk into the court. They send a document to you. You have a response for them. They can reply to your reply, and you get a chance to reply to them. In South Africa, it's basically a case that the person who initiates the case gets to write the original document, and they can reply to you once. You can reply to them twice. So in other words, both of you have had two documents of your own that you produce. So in total, there are now four documents. And after that initial back and forth between your accuser and yourself, you are now sitting with four documents, and that's it. The rest of this will now be resolved in court. And when you go to court, the only things that you can deal with are the things that are in your documents. It doesn't matter whose document it is in, it must be in one of those four documents. If you are in the court and you now suddenly want to start talking about something else that is not mentioned in those documents, that might not be allowed. So those initial documents that happen before you even go to court are actually utterly critical. They are terribly critical. And anything that you leave out there, you cannot go and discuss that in the court later on. So when those documents come at you, you must jump around and start reading those documents and start replying to every damn thing. And you must find every piece of evidence, every counter-argument you can think of. You must throw it into there. So just to give you an idea of the basic strategy that one needs to follow in court. When someone accuses you of something, you have every right to deny it. If someone accuses you of something, even if it's true, you can say, I deny everything. I deny everything. And you need to prove it. And I want to tell you that that is the real way to do things. If anyone comes at you with anything legal, you deny everything all the time. And you say to them, I deny absolutely everything. And you need to provide the proof that any of what you're saying is true. That's the first thing you do. So you deny it and you say to them, you provide the proof. I'm not going to provide the proof. Why am I going to incriminate myself? So the onus is to push it right back at them and say to them, I deny absolutely everything you say. You've got to prove everything. Then when they come with their evidence, your next task is you've got to undermine the evidence, tear it down, attack it using every conceivable method that you can. So if you deny everything, put the other side to the proof for everything, and you then undermine, attack, belittle, and smash back at any of their evidence. That's the way to deal with any legal matter. At the end of this video, there's a 30-minute video where Eustace Mullins gives a talk, and we'll revisit Eustace Mullins. But you'll see right in the beginning of that video that Eustace Mullins says, deny everything. I want to tell you, that is the most important thing. Don't ever feel intimidated. The system is designed as a fighting system, and you go in and you fight for yourself to the maximum. And you do everything you can to undermine the other side. And if they come up with evidence, your goal is to throw as much doubt and counter-arguments at their stuff as possible. And I'll tell you, when I looked at court documents in the beginning, I was very overwhelmed by this whole thing. But I must tell you, by the time this thing ended, I was quite familiar with court documents and legal stuff. And I must tell you that there was a side to this that I quite enjoyed when I looked at this. The nerdy side of me likes this. There is a lot of good stuff in there. So if people just understood that you are dealing with words and everything you're dealing with is written on paper, you need to know the laws. You need to read those laws, and you are going to have to know exactly what is in that law that pertains to your particular case. And your goal is to show that you did not violate it. So if someone charges you or initiates the case against you, your goal is to show that you did not violate that law. Of course, the other side of the coin is you could sue people. Eustace Mullins talks a lot about suing people. And I must tell you that that is the one area that I look at. And I so wish I could do that. That is an area that I really wanted to get into, was to pull off the things that Eustace Mullins was pulling off. Laying charges against people and organizations, suing them. Because, you see, when you get into courts, the court is where there's power. And if the judge or the magistrate determines that you are the winner, then that is the law. the court is there to enforce the law, but if the court finds that you were right and the other guy was wrong, then the state is now going to force that person to pay you money or do something. That is the power of the law, and it is really an important area. So it's not just always about being under attack, but the fact that the white right should be going on the attack. I myself really wanted to do this. I did pull off something in a what I could call semi-legal way. That is something I did do. I didn't do it through taking an organization to court, but I gave them enough threats that looked legal that I managed to get them to back down. However, what I really would love to do is to sue organizations. The more I look at legal stuff, I think we should be aspiring to doing the stuff that Eustace Mullins was doing. That man got further than anyone else. Possibly Tom Metzger was the next best. But what I love about Eustace Mullins was just doing it by himself. He liked reading. He liked doing the nerd thing, and he was having a shitload of fun with that. And that is a lot of power. And the white right could tap into that power. It is something I've wanted to do many times. There are other things I've not told people. There are a bunch of things that I investigated in the past, and then I was thinking, if only I could get into court. When I was thrown off YouTube, I actually went and did my own homework on whether I could sue Google. But you know what was the problem? In the end, was talking to attorneys. So let me just discuss this affidavit thing, but in terms that have meanings in other countries. In the United States, they don't use affidavits, but it's basically the same thing. They file pleadings. So the American term for what we would call an affidavit is a pleading, and it's a complaint and an answer. We use the convoluted terminology of defendant and plaintiff and all that, which I find confusing. The American system is much easier to understand. It's a pleading with a complaint and an answer, and it involves a discovery phase. So all that stuff that's done in the documents before you walk into the court, I cannot emphasize how important that is. Those pieces of paper that you prepare before you walk into the court, they may be more important than the time that you spend in court. Because if you leave things out, if you are sloppy, but the other side is not sloppy, you will find yourself in court and you will then discover that there are things you cannot talk about, there are things you cannot raise. Why? Because it's not in the documents. Those documents beforehand are so important. So in the United States, the parties use pleadings, and so there's somebody who initiates a complaint, and then the defendant answers. In the United Kingdom, the system seems to be the same as South Africa, because South Africa, Canada, and Australia are basically on the British system. In Europe, the system seems to be like the American system. It works on pleadings. And the court directs the exchange of these submissions. The court probably decides how many times you can do back and forth and whatever else you may do. But I cannot stress enough to you the importance of written words, reading the law, knowing the law. Now, let me explain something about hate speech. This doesn't really apply so much to the Americans, because American freedom of speech is the greatest freedom of speech on the planet. But for everybody else who's not in America, if you go and you look at those hate speech laws, and you familiarize yourself with those hate speech laws, then you will see that there are many ways of approaching these problems. That simply by functioning in a certain way, you will never be found guilty of hate speech. You just need to know the finer details of those laws. That is where you've got to read those laws and know those laws. So this will apply to things like hate speech, to things like Holocaust denial, etc. There are some things that you will be able to say, and you may be able to skirt around certain things. But you need to read the law. At the end of the day, everything's going to be determined by what is written in the law and whether you violated that law or not. But remember that the legal system is limited to only implementing the law. The courts are there and the police are there to implement the law. So there are many opportunities for you to still do things, even when there are certain laws, but you must be very familiar with that law and you must know how far you can go and what you can say. Because if you go beyond a certain point, then there's no way you're going to get out of it when it comes to speech and to being limited in the things that you're allowed to say. You've got to be so careful. But if you know the law, then you can play the game. So take, for example, Leslie Borie. What Leslie Borie said would not be a crime in the United States. In the United States, Leslie Borie wouldn't get into any trouble. But in Canada, yes, he's going to get into trouble. If he said the same thing in South Africa or in Australia, he'd be in deep shit. And so that is the thing that people outside of America need to understand. There are things Americans can say that you can't say. Someone who does have a good grasp of the limitations of American law is Alex Linder. Alex Linder knows about certain things. He can go up to that point and he can say that and it's fine. But there are things that Alex Linder can say that I can't say and that anyone outside America cannot say. I'm going to add another little piece in here, and it is to do with the strange structure of the courts in the British and European systems. In America, strictly speaking, there is only one type of legal practitioner, a lawyer or an attorney. In the courts, there is only one type of lawyer or attorney. But in South African and British and certain European systems, you get two levels of lawyers. In South Africa, we would call them a lawyer and an advocate. But the terms in Britain could be solicitor and barrister. So solicitor, attorney, lawyer are the lower attorneys. They function in the lower courts. The barristers and the advocates function in the higher courts. So for example, when I went to court and the Jews were throwing everything at me, they brought in the highest paid advocate in South Africa into a lower court. And the way that our system works is that an advocate cannot function in a lower court without the permission of a normal attorney. A normal attorney has to give that guy permission to appear in the lower court. Many of these things, I think, are also something of a money-making scheme. But when I look at the American system, it's much more simplified. It's much more logical. I think the British system that we've inherited is quite a convoluted thing. But the basic principles are the same. So let me tell you where there's a big weakness that I saw here in South Africa. I found that in my case, getting a lawyer was a nightmare, was an absolute freaking nightmare. Getting a lawyer was a crazy, crazy difficult thing. I battled a lot. I was functioning for months without any lawyer that could help me at all. I did manage to get a couple of guys who would quietly behind the scenes, like tell me a few things. But otherwise, I was on my own and I didn't know my ass from my elbow. It was nasty. It took me perhaps about 6 months to try and find an attorney. Meanwhile, I already had to appear in court, etc. And it was there that I started learning, and I saw many things in the South African courts that showed me the weakness of the legal system, that there are lots and lots of white attorneys who won't touch anything that relates to the Jews. They won't defend you at all. You are just screwed. The fact that I managed to just survive this was something of a miracle, I must tell you. In the case of people like Alison Chablot, the Schaeffers, they seem to have had pretty decent legal advice. However, it does appear to me that there are quite a lot of whites who are struggling. And I've heard many discussions and claims that whites are going to have legal help. Like in America, that bunch of people who are doing the NJP. I knew someone from the Fash Bash who was working with the people who formed the NJP, and I believe that the NJP does not exist as a political party, and I'm not even sure if they function at all as a group. But I was told that the NJP was going to have some means of giving people legal advice. But when I questioned this particular contact of mine and I tried to speak to someone who was an attorney, I couldn't get one. I have on a number of occasions approached people where I was led to believe that there's an attorney. And at the end of the day, I never really found anyone who actually lifts a finger. I thought South Africa was the worst. In South Africa, I would say whites who are doing racial stuff are hardly going to find anyone who defends them. Even though these guys are there, the fact is, these people do not believe in us. These people are weak and useless. And a big thing that I saw in South Africa is that lawyers are very afraid of getting involved in controversial stuff because they fear losing business. That's the real issue. They fear losing business. So I must tell you that it's not the law itself that I think is that bad, or even the silly courts. Even the times that I spent in court, it wasn't the court that freaked me out. The thing that freaked me out the most is the lack of attorneys and legal knowledge for the white right. That is what freaked me out the most. That there are no lawyers who have the balls or the integrity or the will to defend other whites. The attorney I had was probably the only guy in the country. And when I look at the American situation, it should be a lot better in America, but I'm not really sure. I've heard of people talking many times about getting lawyers and legal help, and I must tell you, it's like, if there's anything out there, I don't think there's much. And for people in the white right, you need someone on your side, someone who believes in you, someone who's going in to fight for you. I have thought of trying to do the Eustace Mullins thing. It really attracts me. It really is something that I'd love to do, and I'd love to encourage other people to do it. However, having been in court, and I must tell you, I was on the receiving end of the most highly paid advocate in South Africa. I was on the receiving end of that. And my very first court session was a nightmare. And I got whacked simply because I did not have a proper lawyer willing to be there with me. But the problem that I saw was that there's a lot more to the law. And that Eustace Mullins talks about things like motions. And a lawyer can play many games in court. And if he comes up with certain things in court, it can really put you in a very tight spot where he will do something and you'll have no clue what he's busy doing. So that practical side of it is the one area that I looked at and I thought that is the biggest weakness that I see in the Eustace Mullins approach. Not for Eustace Mullins, but for other people like myself to get to the same level as Eustace Mullins. It requires a lot more work. But what I like about the court thing is that the court thing gives you power. And in theory, we can even sue people and get money out of people, or sue people and cause them to lose money, even if we don't gain money out of it. And that kind of mechanism, that is the kind of punch that whites need to pack. The white right lacks the ability to land punches on people. Jews are landing punches left, right, and center on anybody and everybody. And the white right needs its own attack dogs who are determined and who know the law and who can get in there and counter these people, so that it's not this one-sided thing. At the moment, it's always Jews hitting whites. Jews are hitting whites in every country, and it's Jews are attacking whites. And the whites don't have the means and the organization to counter-punch. Because you can't just sit there and always be on the defensive. You need to be able to counter-punch and land punches on them. Because if you do that, then that really will stir things up in a big way. Guys who tried to land big counter-punches were Ernst Zundel in Canada. Ernst Zundel fought the greatest set of court cases ever. Then you had Douglas Christie, who must have been the greatest attorney that any whites ever had in the Western world, a white man who really fought for whites. He was amazing, Douglas Christie. David Irving was also starting to go down this road. And the way that the Jews beat David Irving was they threw $30 million into getting lawyers and things to fight David Irving. Many people like to knock David Irving for losing that court case, but I must tell you, David Irving landed some punches, and he was fighting way above the normal weight level of anybody. The fact that he lost a court case when Jews pumped $30 million into that same trial, I think we got to take our hat off to David Irving, that David Irving was trying to fight a battle at a level beyond what anyone else was. What is really missing in the white right, and which can be done, is what I could call nerd warfare, where we fight back legally and we fight back politically. We need much more potent nerd warfare. But of the nerd warfare that we can do, the one that has got the meanest punch of all is lawfare. Because if you have the ability to do like Eustace Mullins, and if something crosses your path and something is trying to stuff you up, and you can go and sue them, you can go and lay charges against them, then I can tell you that will shake the opposition up big time. Because if the opposition knows that whites can come and start suing them and hauling them into court, and charging them with this and charging them with that, that is going to be a big game changer. And I've never yet seen people go down that path. And yet, when I look back on my own experiences, I walked away with the view that if you just had people who believed in this kind of stuff and sat down and did the work, that we could corner some people. And you see, like Eustace Mullins wanting to sue people, I looked at many times when I wanted to sue people and organizations that were causing harm to me or my website. I wanted to go and grab these liberals and land a fucking punch on them. And to me, the only thing that seemed to be missing were lawyers who were willing to do something for the cause, because all the others are just commercial. They aren't going to do anything for you. They will cost you insane amounts of money. The common man cannot afford them. And even if they get into court, they're not going to do much. And I must tell you, when I looked at court stuff, The documents are even more important than the appearance in court. If you haven't done your homework and you haven't got your stuff ready, you're going to be wiped out in court on your first day. Snowy Smith used to pride himself on his documents, that when he gets the documents right, the person's going to win the case. And I myself saw documents, written words, that's it. Because once you got all that stuff down, then the rest of the stuff in the court is simply some arguments about what's in the documents. You are just arguing about some of the points that are in the documents. But the documents can already determine whether you stand a chance of winning. Most of your chance of winning is already determined before you're even in court. It's all in the documents. And this young guy who spent a month in jail in a European country, when he now told me a little bit of what happened, I want to tell you that in his case, he was talking about something that was quite innocent, but he was sharing it a lot on groups in the white right, on Telegram. And I'm convinced that what caused him a problem was the enemy. The enemy was sitting there somewhere in those groups. The enemy was seeing the stuff that was moving around. And they then went to the police and then said to the police, charge this guy. In exactly the same way that I showed you that the Jews from B'nai B'rith in Canada were admitting that they went and communicated with their agents in Germany, who then communicated with the German government. That is how the process works. It's not that the police are looking to arrest you. It is that Jewish spies are sitting in the white right and they are monitoring different people in different groups. And if they see an opportunity to nail someone, then they do. And when I look at the many times that people have gone to court, like that guy from Smoloko, Jews know the legal system and the laws so well, and there are many, many times when they want to nail you, but they can't because they don't have the evidence. And the people who do get nailed either don't have anyone to defend them and they panic, or they've done something silly, and then the Jews see, yes, that person's done something, and if we can tell the cops about it, it's a bit dodgy, but they might convict the guy. And that is how they take people down. Then there's something else that I saw. This was from personal experience and monitoring South African court cases. The other thing the Jews do is the Jews will put someone under pressure, and they'll put someone under pressure in the hope that the person makes a mistake. So they'll come at you with something. The thing they're coming at you with is actually likely to fail, but they are hoping that in your inexperience and your panic that you will make a mistake, and then you will say something, you will do something, and then they'll be able to nail you for that thing. That is how they'll get you. That is what I saw. They have enough experience that they know they are dealing with inexperienced people, and that when they put an inexperienced person under a lot of stress, that person is going to go and then make a real mistake, and they'll be able to take that mistake and run to the police or the courts and hit you with charges for that. That is something I watched. I watched it and I personally experienced it. And so you see, the whole thing is, if you don't have the means to hit back and you're just constantly being beaten up, that is a bad thing for us. We do need to be able to hit back. And to me, it doesn't look like it's that difficult. And I'm amazed that in the whole of South Africa, and it seems to me in many other countries, in many places, it is really difficult to sort this out. And I can't understand why all these groups and things are all collapsing. In fact, it appears to me, I could be wrong, but it appears to me that maybe the NJP doesn't even really function in America. I don't know why these people are falling apart like this. So these are some thoughts about lawfare, and that this is one of our biggest weaknesses. Whereas if we had some kind of socialist legal system where we could do some legal fighting, then it would allow us the ability to go and engage in what I would call nerd warfare. And you could use nerd warfare against anyone. You could use it against companies that are closing people's bank accounts down. You could do all sorts of things. You should be able to take the Jews to court. I must tell you, when I look at a lot of these things, I think that either people don't know how important this is, or people are too despondent. I don't know what the story is. But I must say, I lost a lot of respect, huge amounts of respect for your normal commercial attorney. I lost huge amounts of respect. I was very disgusted from my own experiences. And I could see that even the little bit of certain things that I did, I could see that it was not wasted. It was definitely not wasted. Eustace Mullins seems to be the best of all the white guys who taught himself legal stuff. Of course, if you could have attorneys like Douglas Christie in Canada, but these people are few and far between. But I'm amazed that people don't realize the importance of nerd warfare. If we can sue people, and we can engage in court actions against people. Let me explain something. Even if you end up losing, the advantage of the Eustace Mullins method is that if you've got a bunch of people who can create a case and land a punch on a business or an organization, even if you lose the case, the mere fact that you can take them to court or threaten them with legal action. The mere fact that they have to call in their attorneys, and let me tell you, not just calling in their attorneys to reply to you, if you can get them into a position where they have to go to court and meet you in court and you stand in front of a judge or a magistrate, I must tell you that having that ability is a very potent thing. And in this day and age, especially now, as things are getting worse and worse, if you can bleed a company or an organization, you can cost them money by dragging them into court. Even if you lose and you walk away with minimal losses, but you drag them into court, you wasted their time, their management was worried and concerned and had to pay for it. Let me tell you, if we have that kind of power, then we could use that power in a big way. One could go and tackle media companies. Don't you imagine that big companies aren't afraid of lawsuits? They may have their own legal department, but let me tell you, they don't want to be dragged into court. And their lawyers are advising them all the time on how to avoid going to court. The white right lacks the punch. The white right has got punch in the sense that the white right can put out videos. The white right's got websites. The white right's got platforms. We even have our own social media. But the thing that we lack in order to get into the big boys game is legal punch. Because if you can drag people into court, even if you can go and lay charges against them and start messing them around the way that Eustace Mullins does, that's power. And if we had that kind of power, if we could have that kind of ability that Eustace Mullins has, I'm telling you, man, that is what the white right needs. We need to be able to land freaking punches on people. Legally, in court, let me tell you, just the ability to initiate things will mess our enemies around a lot. You cannot always be on the defensive. You must have that ability to land your own punches. And when they know that you can and will land punches on them, it will cause them to back down and to have to change their tactics. This business of just whites losing court cases, whites going to jail, this is starting to irritate me. And from my own experiences, I saw enough. that I walked away with the view that whites actually stand a chance. As bad as the systems are, even in South Africa, whites actually still stand a chance, even in these useless courts. And there were a number of times when I just went to court to just sit in a court because my attorney said to me that while we were waiting for things, that it might be a good exercise for me to spend some time in court. And I went to the local courts. I'd take a morning and I'd go to a court and I'd walk around and I would see which cases are coming up. And I'd just go and sit there in the court and start listening. And today I'd listen to this case. Next week I'd go again. I'd listen to another case. Or if this case bores me, I leave the court and I walk into another court and I listen to another case. I did that quite a few times and I found it very interesting. And I walked away with the view that the thing that is messing us around is that we don't take legal stuff seriously enough. And we think too much in capitalist terms instead of thinking in socialist terms, which is go and learn how to do something. Or find someone who's willing to donate some of their time either to advising us or to helping a bit and guiding us, etc. Among the things that I did that I learned from Snowy Smith, there was one thing I learned from Snowy Smith that helped me massively. A simple thing that I did, which Snowy Smith told me about, and which saved me a lot of money in my own legal stuff here, was in South Africa, you've got someone who's known as the sheriff of the court. The sheriff of the court. In America, it's called a process server or sheriff, and the same terms are used in Canada, process server or sheriff. In Europe, the titles are varied. It can be called a bailiff. The person can be called a bailiff. But bailiffs, sheriffs, process servers, these are the people that you have to pay money to in order to go and drop off a document. And it's an expensive business because every document has got to go. And when you are doing these documents that are going back and forward, those documents have to be lodged with the court itself. And if you are replying to the other side, you've got to drop off documents at that attorney. And there's a process for it. And if the process is not followed properly and those documents are not handed over and signed for properly with proofs, then they are null and void as far as the case is concerned. But you pay for this. And Snowy was the guy who told me that I could do the sheriff's duties myself. And in all my legal stuff, I did exactly that. All the stuff of going to the court, handing in the documents, making copies of the documents, making sure that the copies are done properly, and dropping it off at the court. And I personally went and dropped documents off at the Jew's attorneys myself. Every single freaking document that I needed to deliver to them, I went and delivered it myself. And their black staff signed for it. I walked straight into their offices and handed over the stuff. I did all of those things. And I must tell you, it's simple and basic work. And just by doing that simple and basic work myself, it was way cheaper than making use of sheriffs. That is how I managed to save money when I was doing my legal stuff. So, with a guy like Eustace Mullins, if you can write your own documents, if you can deliver your documents or take care of certain things, then you're already able to get a lot more done. And this thing of paying other people to serve documents, etc., you should be able to go and do it all yourself. I did it myself. And I had hundreds and hundreds of pages of stuff to do. My stuff was nasty. And just doing all those things, I learned how to go to the clerk of the court, deal with the clerk of the court. It's not a big, difficult task at all. And I want to repeat, even if you lose a court case, it depends how you lose it. Even if you lose a court case, you go and sue someone and you lose it and you don't get any money. But the fact that you hauled them into court and you were able to waste their time and them using the proper processes, them paying for the process servers, paying for all the legal stuff. It's a big expense. So if we operate in a cheaper way while costing them a lot of money, then the only thing that you need to avoid is, let's say you sue them for something and you fail. The only thing you don't want to happen is you don't want the magistrate or the judge to order that you pay their legal expenses. As long as you don't have to pay their legal expenses, you're good to go. You're good to go. If you pay your legal expenses and they pay their legal expenses may well exceed yours massively. So you just have to know your game as to whether your case is too frivolous. If your case is too frivolous, then the magistrate may order you to pay their legal expenses. But I must tell you, courts, I looked at this thing and I really, really think that Matt Hale was onto something. He just had too many enemies. He had too many enemies who were already on to him, and he was blocked from practicing, etc. But Eustace Mullins may therefore be the best example of a normal citizen being able to do court stuff, because the law allows you, as a individual, the law allows you to appear in court. You don't have to have a lawyer. The very first time I appeared in court with the Jews, I didn't have a lawyer. I just had someone who was willing to tell me a few things behind the scenes, but that was it. I appeared in court alone, up against the most expensive advocate in the whole of South Africa. And that was a freaky experience. So I don't advise that for most people. For most people, I advise that they get some kind of legal help. But I must tell you that I still think in the white right, we should be looking at things where we can take people to court or help to save people money in court. There's got to be something that can be done there. This business of always being the Jews' punching bag, that's wrong. That is wrong. Jews, liberals, everybody can beat up on us and we can't land counter punches on them. This is a big, big weakness. I'm going to end with a 30-minute talk from Eustace Mullins where he's just talking about courts and procedures. It's nothing very specific, but he chats and he talks about what he's doing and you get a bit of a feel for it. Eustace Mullins, to me, was a pioneer in this. And if we could just find people with some kind of legal experience or actual lawyers who could help us do certain things, it would be awesome. The law is not as buggered as you think. And neither are governments. The real issue is Jews running around spying on people and then either laying charges against those people or running to the cops and telling the cops, "Ah, you see, that guy over there, he did that. You need to deal with him." That's what they're doing. The exact same process that they used against Alfred and Monica Schaefer, that exact same process is the process they're using against everybody. And so another lesson for people is, even if you're doing pretty innocent stuff, be careful which groups you are on and whether you are just happily blabbering to lots of people and there are nasty enemies sitting there trying to see if there's something that you are saying or doing that can be used against you. And I think that is how this young guy ended up with a month in jail. When it comes to groups, you need to make sure that you get rid of all the rubbish. Don't allow rubbish into your groups. If you think that there are spies, get rid of them. Don't mess around. I learned a long, long time ago that if you think that there's a spy or a troublemaker on a group, get rid of that person. Be careful who you associate with. Jews are busy spying on the entire white right, and they are trying to use the police and the government against us. The whole situation is insane. Anyhow, here is Eustace Mullins. He's good fun to listen to, and this particular topic is a topic that will need to be revisited.
And so people ask me when I lecture, say, "Eustace, what do you do about your taxes? How do you handle paying taxes?" I say, "Well, I pay anything I owe." But I've never heard from them, but I owe anything. So I said, "They never call." So I'm not hiding. I'm in the phone book, but they never call. It's a little disappointing in a way. But I mention this simply to show you, after all, as I say, I'm not a lawyer. I have no legal training except what I've undergone myself. But appearing in court is the greatest legal training in the world. Because they're going to throw everything at you that they have, and you either win or lose. Mostly I've won. Like I say, I have my default judgments. They don't bother me anymore. And I do give legal consultations to other people. I tell people, call me anytime. People call me up and ask me about legal problems. And my friends say, well, you don't know who you're talking to. Those are probably agents. And I said, they probably are, but I don't care. And I give them the information, and they can do with it what they want. But like I say, civil procedure is so simple. You only have to do three things. You deny everything, and you answer everything. And as long as you do that, you stay in court. That's it. I just gave you a whole law course. But the last few years, I've done a lot of civil rights cases because, I say, I've been denied freedom of speech and the right to speak many times. And I had a friend named Bo Greitz who has a radio program, and he went up to Cape Cod, and he came back and he said, Eustace, there's a bunch of guys up there, and one of them owns a chain of restaurants. He said, I was up there, and I was wined and dined, champagne, the works. He said, you ought to go up there. I said, well, it sounds very tempting. So I contacted these guys, and sure enough, they said, come on up and speak. So they put out flyers. They called themselves the Freedom Forum. And I was to speak at a Greek Orthodox church. The Greeks, of course, are very prosperous up there. They have restaurants, and they have lots of money. And they built this enormous, beautiful church, which had a lecture room. So they put out the flyers. So then the newspaper attacked. Cape Cod Time did a front page story on me, notorious conspirator who's going to speak in Centerville, which is Centerville, Massachusetts, which is the next town from the Kennedy compound. And so they put pressure on the priest to deny me speaking there. And the priest said, I can't do it. It's a commitment. We've already agreed, and I have no grounds to stop it. So they got desperate, and they started calling him up and saying they were going to blow up the building if he allowed me to speak there. And, of course, under that pressure, he caved in, and he announced the paper that I would not be speaking. So I sued the Cape Cod Times, and when I sued the Cape Cod Times, I realized that it was owned by Dow Jones, the Wall Street Journal. So I sued the Dow Jones Corporation in Virginia. There was a Dow Jones Corporation in Virginia. Well, we went before a federal judge in Virginia, and he said, Mr. Mullins, I have no jurisdiction over this. This is a newspaper in Massachusetts. And so what do you want me to do? And I said, well, I'll sue under jurisdiction. So he moved the case up to Massachusetts. And so my suit against Dow Jones Corporation went right to Massachusetts, Barnstable, Massachusetts. And so they had no intention of ever hearing the case. So they finally dismissed it. And so then I reopened it, because you can always reopen a case. I reopened a case recently that had been summary judgment against me a couple of years ago. And I reopened it on the grounds that I was ill at the time of the judgment and could not respond, could not appeal, which was absolutely true. So I got that going now. And of course, that's the last thing they ever expected, is me to reopen that case. And the judge hasn't answered. Of course, the other lawyers answered, and they're very indignant. This is illegal, and you can't do this, and all this nonsense, which lawyers' responses to pleadings are absolutely primitive. They usually have no logic, and it's just like a fit of temper. Darn it, I'm not going to let you do that. That's the whole idea, you know. And they're so incompetent when it comes to matters of law. They seem to have no respect for law, but of course, being a Freemason Lodge, they don't have to have any logic to what they do. So I eventually had three civil rights cases dismissed in Massachusetts. So I sent due notice to the court, and I pointed out that I had had three civil rights cases dismissed in Massachusetts, denial of jury trial in each one. So I still got one going on because one case where they got summary judgment against me, I refiled against three other people who were involved. I knew the judge was going to rule against me in a few weeks. So I hastily wrote a complaint against three other defendants who were involved, who had not been mentioned in the original case, and drove up there and filed it with the court when it opened at 9 o'clock in the morning. And so after they filed a summary judgment against the Berkshire Eagle case, then I still had the case against these other people. And so then I amended that complaint. I developed cancer, by the way. And I amended my complaint to include the fact that they had caused me to have cancer by all the terrible stresses that they had subjected me to, and that cancer was caused by stress. Well, let's put the lawyers into orbit. They'd never heard an argument like this in their life. And that's still going on. And and now the judge has taken it under advisement, which means he's absolutely terrified and doesn't know what to do. When they take it under, when a judge takes a case under advisement, it means you won't hear from him for at least a year or maybe 2 years. And so I just get busy with other things, you know. You don't sit around waiting for the judge to do something. You get to file some other suit. I got a couple of other. On July the 2nd, my hometown newspaper there in Stanton, Virginia, interviewed me. And they called and said, we want to interview you about Revelation Books. Revelation Books is an imprint under which I published The Curse of Canaan in 1985. It was totally inactive. And so they listed me as one of the leading hate groups in the United States, Revelation Books. So this girl called me up and said, I'd like to interview you about Revelation Books. And I was totally mystified. What was there to say about Revelation Books? Well, she brought in this report from an outfit called Southern Poverty Law Center, which claimed that I was one of the leading hate groups in the United States. That is, Revelation Books was, not Eustace Monk. So I very patiently explained to her that this was all untrue, that there was no hate group, and there was no members, no newsletter, and it was a Christian publishing company, which was inactive. And so she went away, and I thought they would never print it because there was nothing to print. Well, they came out with a front page story, and a lot of stuff from Southern Poverty Law Center that I had been lecturing before all of the leading hate groups in the United States, listing none of them, because there weren't any. I mean, this is the only hate group I've been at lately. You'll probably be called a hate group after I've been here, because... But the guy that ran the Southern Poverty Law Center is a guy named Morris Deese, and he has been so successful, he has raised $500 million cash from suckers through promotions that he's going to fight hate. And, you know, fighting hate is not that hard. You just go out and fight it. And you might have to spend $500 million, but at least you're doing something worthwhile, you know. So I wrote an expose of him about 4 years ago, and what Morris Deese was doing was counterattacking me for writing this expose. Because, of course, he never answered anything. Because what I did, I found his court papers in his divorce. And in the court papers, his wives said that he had urged them to go out and have sex with everybody because he wanted to get rid of them so they wouldn't claim his $500 million. And then he also was caught in bed with a homosexual. He just wanted to try it, apparently. And this is all court documents that I'm quoting, see. So this was all published and circulated over the United States. And Morris Deese never answered, but he bided his time, and he was going to lay it on me, and he did with this article. So this is actually one of the most blatant attacks on me yet, that I lecture before recognized hate groups, that I have a hate group myself, and which is non-existent. So when I get back, of course, I'll be filing more lawsuits. I'm going to sue for $9 million and $9 million punitive. I always sue for punitive damages because, after all, you suffer a lot when they lay this stuff on you. And mental anguish and suffering is something that has to be atoned for. I have a lot of mental anguish. I may not look it, but... But what I have done is show up the legal system for the totally inconsistent and ridiculous charade that it is. And here the judges and lawyers have been bringing people in for years and stripping them of everything they had. And they also, by the way, for people like myself, they have a special punishment called attorney's fees. And I sued the city of Stanton once for this accident where the guy tried to kill me. They had two black women who came to be as prospective jurors, and the lawyers for the opposition immediately shot them down and got them out of there very quickly. And because black women tend to be very generous in judgments against insurance companies, and lawyers know this, so they hustled these two black ladies out, and they weren't on my jury. And this was the jury where they said I backed into the car and smashed in the side of my car. So after this case was over, I sued the city for discrimination for not allowing the black women on the jury, which, you know, was a very hot issue at that time. And so we went into federal court, and of course the judge was not very sympathetic at all. But I noticed that the attorney for the city kept jumping up and saying, Your Honor, attorney's fees, attorney's fees. And the judge would look at him, and the judge was no friend of mine, but he said, no, I'm not going to award attorney's fees against Mr. Mullins. And the guy would jump up a couple minutes later, attorney's fees, attorney's fees. And he'd say, no, I'm not going to award attorney's fees. So I got to thinking, why is the judge not going to award attorney's fees against me? Because he's no friend of mine. And I finally realized that when you represent yourself, that the other side cannot assess attorney's fees against you greater than your own fees, which in my case were none. So I've been using this ever since. So if they ever want to assess attorney's fees against you and you represent yourself, you realize they cannot do it, because apparently under procedure, you cannot assess attorney's fees against a litigant which are greater than the other side's attorney's fees. And I've been riding on that ever since. You find out these things as you go along. That's why I say when you go into court, you win, because you find out things you would never know otherwise. And I've been using that, and of course, I'm using cancer and I'm using everything because you use what is there. But the lawyers get so frustrated with me because they called in my witness in this case in Massachusetts for a deposition, and I was a little worried about it because he's very naive and had no legal experience. I knew they would make mincemeat out of him. So I flew up there to be there when he was there, and after I got there, I looked at the summons for the deposition, and it said, Stephen May, who is the plaintiff's witness, is hereby summoned to, that the plaintiff hereby summons him to this deposition in the offices of the defendant's attorneys. So I looked at it, and I said, well, that's kind of odd, because I'm not holding this deposition. So when I got there, I asked the attorney. He started off right asking questions, very hostile to my witness. And finally, May said, Mr. Mullins wants to say something. Well, so I said, Mr. Pesolano, I think we're here under false pretenses. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, this says that I, the plaintiff, am holding this deposition. I have nothing to do with this. He said, let me see that. You know, like he had never seen it. He had signed it. He had read it and approved it. He had two attorneys in his office signed it and approved it. He looked at it. He saw right away. He said, oh, clerical error. Well, go ahead. And I said, well, I beg your pardon. I said, we're here under false pretenses, and it would be illegal for us to proceed. And his face turned absolutely black with hatred of me. And he said, point well taken. And he closed down the deposition. So then they tried to summon May back again, but they got the wrong address, and the time expired, and they never did have the deposition. But that was the most humiliating experience that guy ever had, was for me to call him down. Now, you see, another lawyer would have been gracious and said, yes, clerical error, let's go ahead and proceed and just ignore it. But I said, no, it's illegal. It's false pretenses, which it was. The summons was totally false. Said I was having the deposition. I had nothing to do with it. So always be prepared to object, speak up, defend your own interests, and that's the way it's done. And that makes you a lawyer. You are now a practicing lawyer, You can go into any court in the United States, and as I say, deny everything and answer on time. The time limits are very important because the courts are absolutely ruthless towards people who represent themselves. If you're a day late, they'll throw you out. Now, if you're a lawyer, they'll give them a little grace. They say, well, okay, we'll give you a couple of days extra. But if you represent yourself and you miss the time limit, believe me, they will rule against you every time. Because after all, you're the enemy. They want to get you out of there any way they can. So I think I'm running a little out of toward the end, but I'd like to have a few questions from you. I know you've all had legal problems from time to time. And as George Gordon says, surviving in the courts not only is an absolute necessity, but it can also be a hell of a lot of fun.
I was taken to court by Revenue Canada, and my husband defended me, Bruce Steller. I agree with you. It was amazing the amount of incompetence.
Oh, it was.
Mind-boggling. It was very enjoyable. It was fun. As a matter of fact, when my husband was finished with the 20-year auditor, I felt so sorry for her. I went up and gave her a hug. I felt so sorry for that woman. But we had a mistrial because the judge took us in the back room with the prosecutor to tell the prosecutor how badly he was doing.
Oh, yeah.
And he used that to get an apprehension of bias.
Oh, yeah.
So I was wondering if you would sue the prosecutor for that.
Oh, you certainly could, because it's improper, illegal activity on his part. He's liable for suit. See, any prosecutor or public official can be held responsible for their actions. There's nothing in any statute which says that anybody can act illegally. If they go beyond the bounds, they're just as liable as you or me or anybody else.
He got caught doing a few little things there during that trial.
Well, they usually bend the rules. They get so used to it, and they do it.
Yeah.
And nobody ever says anything because they're afraid to do anything about it.
Yeah.
And they get used to getting away with it. They get very, very sloppy and very careless, and they leave themselves wide open.
Yeah, it almost seemed like a conspiracy to me.
Oh, it is conspiracy.
Yeah.
It's conspiratorial. After all, it's a Freemason lodge operation.
And the Crown prosecutor seemed very worried about what we were going to do from that point on. He was trying to explain himself at the end of the trial, after the mistrial. He was trying to explain how his intentions were really honorable. He wasn't, you know, we're looking at him going, we don't want to hear this.
He probably never had an honorable intention in his
life.
But you know, there's no statute of limitations on that. It comes under conspiracy. You can open that case anytime you like.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
Statute.
What do you think, Bruce?
Yeah, one of my secrets is I use conspiracy all the time. Because, and it is a conspiracy, because that abrogates the statute of limitations. It doesn't matter how many years have gone by, you can always reopen this case. And it's just like a new case right then.
One of the legal issues that I've been wondering about is that I'm a dancer, and as a result, I sometimes frequent particular clubs. And a couple of the issues that come up, which I'm stuck at how to deal with, is one, people blowing smoke in my face, and secondly, music that's so loud that's causing permanent damage to the patrons. And so I'm wondering, is there a possibility of turning to the legal system or filing law? Could I be the first person to file a lawsuit for this type of thing, or how would you recommend I proceed?
Well, there's been a lot of suits in the state on secondhand smoke and also loud noise. So it's actionable on either count or both counts. I would sue on both counts, damage and suffering from eardrums and from secondhand smoke.
Secondly, when I went through my marriage separation, my first lawyer was probably the most popular lawyer to represent men in Vancouver, but extremely incompetent. And when I talked to my lawyer friend, when she found out that I had him as my lawyer, she said, get rid of him immediately. But that was a little bit too late. There was a lot of damage done. And I'm wondering whether it's might be still possible to file a lawsuit against him, and even actually a lawsuit against my spouse's lawyer for the damage that was done to my child, for example.
Yeah. Oh, very much so. As I pointed out, when you file a malpractice suit against a lawyer. It costs him a lot of money, so they don't like to let him lay around. They'll probably try to settle with you pretty quick because they don't like that against their record that the suit has been filed. And also they have a good chance of losing because lawyers lose suits against them in court because nobody likes them anyway, and they know they're incompetent and that all the allegations are probably true. So lawyers have a very bad record for losing in court. So you've got a very good chance on that. And I must say, divorce law is one of the great gold mines of the legal profession. Because once a couple decides to divorce, what they should do is have arbitration and come to an amicable agreement to divide up the property. Because when each side goes out and hires a lawyer, then it's the duty of those lawyers to stir up the wife and husband against each other, make them hate each other bitterly, and make sure that they're so mad they'll never get over it, and then they become putty in their hands, and they can start a war, and the result is that the lawyers wind up with all their property. They wind up with nothing, and they hate each other, and it's just a total disaster, but that's the way lawyers work. Lawyers also in the States have a great habit of when a good-looking young woman walks in and she's going to divorce her husband, the lawyer realizes she's defenseless and alone and usually takes her back in his office for a private consultation. And so things take their course from there. And lawyers are notorious for this. So they take advantage of women terribly. And this is one of the things that they do, one of the illegal and improper things they do. So their treatment of women is almost as bad as the medical profession.
Hi, really enjoyed your talk. I've got a question for you. In civil law in Canada here, law of contract, now they're taking it to arbitration. Prior to that, they will put it to mediation where they try and get you to agree between yourself.
Yeah, arbitration,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and they do this before it goes to court. Now, what would be your comments on that, procedure-wise?
Well, the problem with arbitration or mediation is that you agree to be bound by the conclusion before it's heard, so you're committed once you go into it. I've never gone into arbitration myself because I prefer the court arena and a chance to show off my legal talents. So I would never do that, but it certainly can help, and it's a shortcut, and it could save you some time and money. It would depend entirely on the circumstances and the case itself.
Two quick questions for you, Eustace. Thanks very much. The first one, you made a statement during your discussion about the fact that a judge is obligated to give you legal advice. What is the basis of that?
That's the official rules of the American Bar Association.
Okay.
Because, for many years, nobody ever represented themselves in court, so it wasn't an issue. And people started doing this in the last 25 years, and the American Bar Association had to address the situation. So they came up with the very logical conclusion that, yes, the judge is there as a referee of the parties. And as a referee of the parties, it's his obligation, if a litigant doesn't know what to do, that he should give him a little push in the right direction. But they refused to do it, and the judges say we cannot give legal advice, which is a total lie. And I never got any help from a judge, which was probably a break for me, because I went out and did it myself, and that was worked out the best all the way around. But they are obligated. You can, of course, you have the Canadian Bar Association. They probably have the same rules. But you could point out that the obligation is for him to help you.
That leads in perfectly to my next question, because you've talked about the American Bar Association and the Canadian Bar Association.
Yes.
And I would like you to confirm that indeed the word bar stands for British Accredited Regency. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. This all comes out of England. And that's why I was talking about the London connection and the Bank of England, because our CIA, our intelligence agency, was conceived right in London by Lord Mountbatten and three members of the British General Staff. Our Evangelical Association came out of British Secret Service in 1848, Lord Palmerston. So everything that we have is really secondhand. It comes through England first, and so what we should do is just have a queen and be done with it. You know?
Thanks so much.
Surely.
Thanks for coming, Houston. It's great to have you. I have a question for you. I've got the tyrants from Revenue Canada. They invited me to court, and they've got a lot of documents on me, and I don't think it's really, well, I know it's not their, it's not in their jurisdiction, even have it in their possession. How would I turn that tide to be the plaintiff on that?
Have they filed charges against you? You're a defendant, are you?
Yeah, for not filing.
For not filing, oh yeah. Well, there again, once you become a defendant, it's very hard to switch over and be a plaintiff. Unless you go into another jurisdiction and file against them as a plaintiff, which you can do. You could actually say, they're Canadian and you're what, U.S.? Or
I'm a Canadian.
Well, you can file in your own jurisdiction against them. And it's amazing what a countersuit will do. It reverses everything. That would be my advice. Countersue them in your own jurisdiction and they'll probably drop the whole thing.
Okay, thanks for your time.
Sure.
Hello, Eustace. I have one quick comment and then a question to leave you with. 1990 Thompson decision in Canada's federal court system, Superior Court of Canada, was upheld in 1996, upheld an Ontario Court of Appeal 1990 ruling in the Thompson case. It's a matter involving a corporation. That criminal acts in Canada are not fundamentally illegal.
Hmm.
There's only a penalty if you get caught.
Oh, yeah.
But they're not prohibited.
Not prohibited. That's interesting.
And so that's something I find quite interesting as well. So I wanted to share that with you. And also, David Wynn Miller you referred to, or is it another David Miller?
David Wynn Miller. Yeah,
can you elaborate on your relationship with his personally or his procedures?
It's not personal. We write the same papers, contact. But I found a lot of David Wynn Miller's conclusions were very good, and some of his stuff I could use. But fundamentally, I found in dealing with Internal Revenue and dealing with the courts, it comes down to your individual decision as to how you're going to defend yourself and use the particular elements of your own situation to do it. Like as I say, I went after the FBI and IRS for conspiracy to put me in a mental institution. And if you look at your situation, you can always find something you can use. Just examine it very closely and figure out what's going on and how you want to go about it.
So this question's on, it's a domestic issue. If a plaintiff enters an action against you and as a defendant, you wind up getting orders in your favor, and subsequently the plaintiff decides to drop the action, does that nullify the orders that the defendant achieved?
Generally, yes. If the plaintiff drops the action, it's called a non-suit, then that voids the decision, usually.
Thank you very much for listening today. I hope that you learned something new today. Look after yourselves and take care. We'll be chatting again soon.
Give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win every fight. You